Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Karina here. Hope everyone has been having a good Monday afternoon. And to start off, could I ask you to say who's on the phone?
Tom from Arizona.
Nashville.
Sharon from University of Delaware Center for Disability Studies.
Amy from Missouri Lind.
John from Arizona.
Nancy from New Mexico.
Center on Disability Studies, University of Hawaii.
Michaela Collins from the University of Vermont.
Raylan Smith in Alaska.
Vicki Scott, New Mexico.
Christine from California Lind.
Deborah from USC USA.
Cheryl Everett, Louisiana State University.
Tamara Hager, the Neisunger Center at The Ohio State University.
Zeba Argerman from New Jersey.
Dree Bulow from Iowa, you said, and company.
Stacy from Montana.
From Arkansas.
Will Martin from Arizona.
Jeannie Ramos from Bronx.
Jesse Edinger from Portland, Oregon, you said?
Okay. I take it that is everyone for today. So thank you to all those of you who are able to make the call today. And before we go into the agenda, I just wanted to give you a quick update about the product dissemination tool. Based on your feedback, I've received via email as well as what we talked during the call 2 weeks ago, we have made or are in the process of making a couple of tweaks to it, just to make it even better. The functionalities are not changing, so it's all, functional the way it is, but we are doing a few changes, such as putting different colored lines for the product listed to be sure that nobody enters the wrong number for the wrong product. Also, the ability to clear everything and start from the beginning. The language has been tweaked a bit. So basically small things, just based on your recommendations that we found very helpful. And they were implemented on our test site or development site last week. So I expect to see them on live this week as well. But again, nothing to affect the functionality the way it is now, just a few improvements. So then to go to the next topic that remained from the last call, it was about products and information dissemination, but more specifically about how USAID comply with the requirement to sample users of their web pages for the dissemination satisfaction measure. So would someone want to start and give an example of how that is done at their center?
This is Michaela from Vermont. I think I sent one of those questions in. We currently send out an email survey to our CAC and selected others to get dissemination satisfaction, just the simple questions, and we ask a couple other questions. But I wonder if other people are doing other things. I mean, this is it's not too hard. I don't mind doing it, but it is difficult some years to get enough people we have to pick out people to send to because they require such a high response rate. So I wonder if other people do it, if they do it on the web, and if they do, how do they measure the percentage of response rate?
This is Cherie at Iowa. We, in the past, have put a link on our webpage to a survey tool and have collected responses that way. Unfortunately, we haven't gotten many responses because it's optional. It isn't mandatory. And therefore, we do have groups such as our CAC. We call them our CPAC team. We send it to them and other groups that we work with closely in collaboration on projects. So we started out trying to do it on the web, but are finding it's more efficient just to send it out in an email, a link.
This is Lori in Nashville. We also have a link on our website, and after asking the initial satisfaction survey, we also ask, would you be willing to answer a few more questions, and it takes into a little bit more in-depth survey. I agree with everyone else. We don't get a huge amount of response from this. We also just recently redesigned our website, and the link is very small at the very bottom of the homepage now. So we also send it out to our CAC and other select people. So just more of the same.
So how do you count how many people you've asked? It can't be everyone that's gone to the website.
No, we certainly don't count everyone who's gone to the website. The survey mechanism we use, REDCap, will give us a column if the survey is complete or not. So if I get one that's incomplete, I know someone came to it and just didn't answer the question. It's not scientifically perfect, but it at least gives me something to work off of.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. We do the same here at Iowa. We look at who has actually clicked on the link, and even if it's incomplete or they just opened it, looked at it, and then closed it, we count them as one person that has gone to that link.
This is John from Arizona. We have a widget on our homepage, and it's basically the complete survey, and they can leave comments to reduce the spam. You can answer a question, and all those results are forwarded to our email, so we get the completed survey results from there. The individuals that we ask that our instructors for classes that we teach through IHD ask the students to go to our website and evaluate it. We find that it's good feedback from them if they're going there for the first time and sort of looking at our website and trying to navigate all the resources. So we get a lot of great comments that way.
Oh, that's a great idea, because sometimes I have a hard time finding the audience for the questions. Some people say, I know people that are connected to a project with you, but they don't really know that much about your USAID, so they don't use your website. So that's a great idea. You send the students right there. I guess my one of the questions was if that's considered a response rate. You're really just counting whoever takes the survey as the response rate. So if that's acceptable, that answers my question.
This is Karina, and I'll jump in only to say that this is not a common question, not something that I'm familiar with getting in previous years necessarily. So if anyone has anything to add or say, please feel free to.
Karina?
Yes.
Karina?
Yes, I'm
Tom,
here. Do you hear me?
From Arizona. We've always perceived trainees as, or students, as part of our consumer base, along with, you know, providers of services, family members, consumers, and the like. So in that regard, considering students or trainees as our consumers, they're most appropriate in our eyes that they would do the consumer satisfaction survey.
Thank you, Tom. That seems right. Does anyone else have something to add to that? Then I guess I'll ask, are there any other questions about this or anything else to add about doing the survey via the website or for the website? Okay, I guess I'll take silence as a no for now. So we can move on to the next topic, which is about the trainees and the interdisciplinary pre-service preparation core function. And there were a few things included, or a few questions that came. And the first is how to determine when to survey a trainee who is in a multiple semester program. And as a reminder, you know, trainees are supposed to be entered in years each fiscal year that they're in the training. But I'm sure there are times when, you know, a training program doesn't go exactly with the academic year. So how do some of you decide when to survey trainees?
This is Tom again. In our case, we have about three different programs that we offer, academic programs. So you and I have talked in the past, Karina, and you have suggested to us, as soon as we get the admission from our university saying that this trainee has been accepted into our program, that's when we enter them as a trainee. It starts from that point, whatever that point is, in the academic year or during the summer, as far as New Year's reporting goes. As far as completion of the program, we continue to continue them until they complete the program. So if some may complete the program, say, in three semesters, some may take six semesters. If it goes over the academic year, then we just carry them over. And when they complete the program, we say they completed and therefore not carry them over to the next reporting year. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Tommy. Definitely does make sense.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead, Karina. It's fine.
I was just going to say it makes sense to me, but I want you to hear from others too. So.
Well, I was going to say it makes sense, but I think the question is about when to survey trainees. And I think our practice has, this is Nancy in New Mexico, and I think our practice has been that they will be surveyed at the end of the fiscal year. And if they are not finished, then they would be surveyed again when they do finish. So they'd actually be surveyed twice. And sometimes we have trainees that start in one program and then they move on to something else and do another program. And so they're trainees in a couple of different ways. And then they get surveyed multiple times as well. I'm not sure if that's kosher or not.
This is Heidi in Iowa, and we have trainees who are here for sometimes five or more fiscal years. So we will enter a continuing resume or update for them every fiscal year they're here, and they do not get surveyed from us until they have completed here. So if they're here for 5 years, their first survey will be after their fifth year, because we feel that we get more value to their responses after they're actually practicing versus continuing to stay in the program.
This is Lori in Nashville. We take the same approach with our USED trainees, in that they don't get surveyed until that first year after they've completed the program. We also have LEN trainees, but they are only here for one fiscal year, so it's a little more cut and dried of when to survey the LEN trainees.
This is David in Arkansas. When you go to the, if you go to the reports for trainee reports and then click on long-term survey information, that list who is to be surveyed by fiscal year. And what it does is it populates them, as several of you were saying, 1 year after their last semester with us. So we would do the first survey then 1 year after their last survey, last semester they complete with us.
Okay. So this is Nancy in New Mexico again. So I guess I was thinking about the other survey. So is the long-term trainee survey for 1, 5, and 10 years post internship. But I was thinking about, you know, the activity core function that requires just the questions that are just about the satisfaction regarding their internship itself. And so that's why I guess we have the practice of doing it every year, because we have that activity every year of how many, you know, trainees are receiving this particular training program, and just to meet response rate requirements.
Yeah, on that note, we actually survey our trainees several times on different activities they do during the year they're with us. So when you're talking about activity satisfaction, we do that depending on the number of activities that they do.
Mm-hmm.
In Iowa, we do a final year-end survey for the LEND class that is based off their current, off the curriculum that they had. But if we have someone who's here for 5 or more years, they're not always in the LEND program. They're probably in LEND for 1 year, but they're a long-term USED trainee, and we still wouldn't survey them for the 1, 5, and 10 year until they completed the last year of their program here.
Right.
But if they're in LEND, they'll get the activity surveys for that as well during LEND.
This is Julie Shears in Madison, Wisconsin, and we do a similar thing. The only thing that ends up catching us up sometimes is when we have second year LEND trainees, and they may not be sequential. So you may have a LEND trainee who has a year or two between when they end LEND, and then they decide to reapply, and they may be accepted as second year trainees. So that always gets a little tricky.
This is Amy from Missouri. Do you still do the 1, 5, and 10 year, like you duplicate it? Our trainees do back-to-back 2 year if they are in the program. So what would be better, to wait until they complete their second year?
I think I'm not sure. Barb Wagner does all of ours, and I believe we reset them and consider their second year when they end as their final year then.
Their final year. Okay.
But it could be, in fact, that there's a gap in between where they're not trainees at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that happen for, say, family. We had that happen when we had a family training.
Mm-hmm. Are they still entered in the system? They're still entered in the system twice, correct?
They are, but their completion year where
is
we
when you
survey them would be when they complete their, you know, I think that, and it's not always known that they're going to reapply, so it just adds another wrinkle to it.
It doesn't hurt to send 2 1-year surveys to somebody if they're several years apart. If they were in your program 1 year and then they were off for 2 or 3 years and then they came back, it's not going to hurt anything if you have 2 1-year responses from them, as long as you don't do the 5-year until their second 5 years up.
Okay.
Okay.
And the system should recognize that they were there again, and it shouldn't send the 5-year off of the first one, because it'll recognize it has a new date.
This is Karina, and I will jump in to say that the system doesn't, or NEARS is not set up to recognize when trainees should be surveyed beyond the terminal year. So that's the main criteria by which NEARS pulls up trainees for when they need to be surveyed, and then the surveys that need to be included in reporting are all based on the terminal year that's entered in NEARS, which is simply the last fiscal year record available for a trainee. So there may be, you know, workarounds, may enter the trainee twice, see if the trainee has been in the program at different times. You know, such things are possible, but in that case, you'd have to make sure to survey the trainee on the regular, you know, at 1, 5, and 10 years for each program they were in, because NEARS does not have a way to combine surveys. It doesn't do any kind of check on the back end. But I think that's a good question, though. I do get that sometimes about how to handle trainees who are out of the program and you don't know when they come back. What do you do at your centers to kind of know and maybe, you know, make sure that whomever has to survey them in the future knows that the trainee has not completed the program? Has that not been the case for folks on the call? You know, to have someone, but you're not sure. And I'm also thinking not just for you who are there, but say, you know, maybe there's another data coordinator who comes down the road. You know, maybe you won't be in that position anymore, and the person needs to know who to survey if someone hasn't completed the program. Do you have any checks in place, or do you have a way to keep track of trainees and communicate that information?
We don't necessarily know that we're going to have a trainee that's a repeater. We know what disciplines that it usually happens in, but as a general rule, until they're here, they may be off for like 3 or 4 months and they thought they were going to be gone and then they're back. So it's just one of those things that you don't know until it happens, and you have to just keep a little list, and we try to keep a record as to their termination date, and then if they come back in, we just add another data record in NEARS for them.
So were there any more questions, just to be sure, about when to survey a trainee? Okay. Then there was another question about who qualifies to be entered as a trainee and when to use the interdisciplinary pre-service preparation core function for activities. And, you know, the basic definition is about trainees being enrolled in an academic program, but I also know there are many nuances to that around the network. So would you mind giving some examples of, you know, how do you differentiate between, you know, students who need to be entered as trainees and those who do not need to be entered as trainees?
Corinna, this is Tom again. In our case, it's rather clear because we have, like I was saying, three formalized training programs. They've all been approved by the university, and at that point, admission into the program is guided by the graduate college. And once they've been accepted into our program and the coordinator of the program accepts them as well, then they become a trainee.
Thank you, Tom. That does sound like it's somewhat easy with a formalized training program. Does anyone have examples of smaller programs where it's harder to know, or it's a smaller number of hours, so it's harder to decide when to enter them as trainees, as or just leave them as activity participants?
This is Lori in Nashville. I have an example. It's regarding intermediate trainees. We have a program where we have usually undergraduates, but some graduate students who sign on to be peer mentors with our post-secondary education program for young adults with disabilities. And if those volunteers,
I just sent you an email.
Usually, if they're a special ed major or another major, or it's just clear they're going to go into the disabilities field, we consider them intermediate trainees. And to be honest, it was based off the survey because we initially thought about considering them all intermediate trainees. However, looking at that 1, 5, and 10 year survey, you know, it doesn't do a lot of good for an engineering student to get that survey in 1, 5, or 10 years. So it didn't make sense to consider them a trainee. However, they do put in the hours. So that's just one example of sort of a smaller program where we kind of pick and choose based on a certain criteria who we consider an intermediate trainee.
On Voluntary, and people who got on and started to answer if they called up. How many people that did it?
This is Nancy in New Mexico, and this has been a big sticking point because I guess it's because we are a LEND program too, and so we have we have goals related to the number of trainees that we have. And so this definition has floated around in lots of different ways. So we have groups of students who come to observe a clinic or something like that. And at times these have been considered short-term trainees. But then we learned that we're not really supposed to put in short-term trainees for USED, only for LEND. And so kind of figuring out even what is the definition of a LEND short-term trainee has been really challenging for us because we have these goals for the number of LEND trainees, and we don't meet that goal just through our LEND program.
I think a lot of USEDs are also LEND.
Yeah. So, yeah, we've been having trouble with this issue.
Yes, I bet you have. You have to be careful. Forget that you're not muted.
This is Amy from Missouri, and we had the same issue come up with the short-term LEND. People that just come and visit the class one time, we count them as a short-term. And it's just for a number count, is my understanding, that it doesn't fit into the big picture. It just shows that we had other people participating.
So then do you collect all that information that is required for the short-term trainee form for those students?
We don't fill out the form. We just count the number. As a, in attendance, if you know, a short-term attendee in the program, mm-hmm. But our trainees do go through an interview process, so we do know the exact number we're going to start with.
The subtitle in this picture is "Get Beachbody Ready."
Okay. So, do those short-term students go through your interview process?
No, they do not. They may be a resident that comes in on a rotation with one of the physicians that's on the grant and just to observe.
That's a training.
Yeah, we have to.
Okay, thanks.
It's a training activity.
They're going to wrap this one up early.
Now, related to trainees, could someone talk also about the pre-service preparation activities you have for trainees? I know I've been getting a few questions lately about what counts as a pre-service preparation activity. So I was wondering if you could give some examples, because I'm not sure if maybe others have questions too, kind of like I've been getting the emails.
Well, this is Nancy in New Mexico, and I guess my understanding, I think this core activity is worded a little bit in a confusing way, because it's obviously for your trainees, but it seems like it is also allowed to be used for, say, when one of your faculty members goes to main campus and does a guest lecture, if those mm-hmm. are pre-service students. And those obviously are not trainees, but they are pre-service. It is pre-service training. So we have been using it for that kind of activity as well, or when a classroom of pre-service students comes to the center for some kind of observation or like one day training or something like that.
Data, see, question, so it's not there.
How about mentoring activities? How do you treat those? Do those get entered as pre-service preparation activities? Yes, no, maybe. Does anyone have mentoring activities?
Well, this is Nancy in New Mexico, and that's a lot of our USED trainees are just that. They're coming to get mentored for many numbers of hours, at least intermediate, sometimes long term. So we do consider that they're coming in to do research, or they are coming in to help with clinics and get that sort of practical field practice kind of experience. And we do put that in under pre-service training. A lot of times it's required for their degrees.
Okay. So thank you. I guess there are no more questions about the pre-service preparation core function and trainees. So I suggest we move on to the next topic, which is about data entry. And I would say I do get quite a few questions about this from centers that are both USED and LEND, and specifically how to select the program type when you enter projects, activities, products. What criteria do you use to decide whether a record is USED only or LEND only or both USED and LEND?
We have one beacon. We do have one beacon in our group. So with the order tomorrow, we need to have some kind of vegetarian, no cheese, no. You said vegan. No byproduct either. So
yeah.
No egg, no, I mean, just strictly vegetables.
Yeah. If I may interrupt, I'm hearing a conversation about food options. Would you be able to mute yourself?
This is Amy from Missouri, and our PI we are, our USET is in Kansas City, Missouri, and we are the Lind in Columbia. And so we enter everything for her as a USET and a Lind. And then our faculty, we enter just as Lind because they don't fall under the umbrella of USET.
This is Lori in Nashville. We are also both a USED and a Lind, and we're housed basically right on top of each other. So a lot of what we do as both USED and Lind. There are a handful of things that maybe just the Lind program does, and those will get categorized as just Lind. There's also a few things that might just be you said, but for the most part, everything we do is pretty interconnected. That's our specific situation, though.
Hi, this is Christine from California Lend. So our program is a joint Lend and you said, and we actually enter, it depends on the faculty who's involved. So a lot of our USED faculty are Lend faculty, in which case we would enter whichever activity as both USED and Lend. But we also have Lend faculty who don't also fall under the umbrella of USED, if that makes sense, in which case that would be entered only as Lend. So I think it's pretty similar to what others are saying for us as well.
Well, this is Nancy in New Mexico, and here's another thing that we've been really having to sort through: what defines Lend and what defines USED. And where we have landed currently is it is Lend if it is paid for at least partially by Lend, or if it is overseen by a Lend faculty. And for us, we don't have any folks who are strictly Lend. If it's overseen by a Lend faculty member, or if it's overseen by a prior Lend graduate, and we have several of those working in the center. And aside from that, most things are, you said we do have some Lend-only activities.
So Nancy, were you wondering how to enter, how to select for your activities, if, for instance, if they are overseen by a Lend faculty member, if to select Lend too?
Right. I mean, I guess that has been our practice. Most things, you know, it's clear if it's Lend only. It's less clear if it's a USED program that is overseen by a Lend faculty member but is not for trainees, is for some other, you know, training professionals, say, or something like that, then it becomes less clear whether that's a Lend program or not. It's not paid for through Lend. It's paid for through some other means, through the USED.
But who administers the program?
A Lend faculty member, if you mean who oversees it.
Then wouldn't that be counted as a Lend activity?
Yes, we do count that as a Lend activity, but not exclusively Lend, because it's not paid for exclusively through Lend, or maybe not even at all.
But you're supporting the Lend faculty.
Correct.
So why not?
Because their whole salary does not come from Lend.
So if a USED faculty comes to the Lend lecture and gives the lecture, they would be counted, that would be a dual count, the USED and Lend, wouldn't it? Or would it just be Lend?
Hard stuff, like we don't have to deal with this.
90% of the answer is they don't care.
Yeah.
AUCD.
That's definitely part of it.
I guess I can't answer that. We have different people doing the Lend-only stuff, and I don't know that we have that happen. I don't know if we have USED probably have guest lecturers from USAID employees in the Lend.
Right. That's,
you know, but I don't know.
Okay.
Yes, I'm here. I heard my name whispered, but I was wondering if others have other things to add to this. And I also think it might have to do with the decision to, as to how you want to report. If it's an activity that you want to report for the Lend program, it should be marked as Lend. If you want it to be reported for the USAID program, it should be marked as USAID. So I think for such things where, you know, it may be a fine line, it may be helpful to even talk with a project supervisor or your center director to kind of decide what needs to get reported where.
Well, Karina, let me ask you this. I mean, is it a problem to have a lot of things that are marked dually? I mean, does that, like, show up as double counting somewhere, or is that really just fine? Seems like,
oh,
a
no, that is absolutely
that.
Fine, and
yeah.
I think it's most common, actually, because when records are pulled for reporting from NIRS, they are pulled based on the program type selected, but they go in different places. It's the USAID PPR for the USAID and the data export for the Lend, and there's no check anywhere. It's perfectly fine if both boxes are checked. Okay. Then there was one last item left from two calls ago. Well, it wasn't left from them, but more questions have come up in the meantime. So since we have a bit of time, I thought I'd bring it up again about collecting the initial outcome measures for technical assistance and how you do that. I know that I did an extra layer of challenge with collecting data throughout the year. So since we are in April now, most of you are probably or have collected some of the initial outcome measures. How do you manage that, especially for activities that, you know, take place throughout the year?
Hi, Karina. This is Sri at Iowa. We actually use Qualtrics as our survey that we send out to a group. We look at all of the TA activities and try to, like, group them together if they're the same individuals. So we are not sending them 10 different surveys. We send them one survey with the survey questions on it. But that's how we do it. We kind of cluster the activities together and then create our survey asking for the initial outcome measures and send it out once a year. We usually send them out in May.
Okay, and then the last couple of questions, I'm reading this from the agenda that I sent out for, you know, for the remainder of this call. When providing support and expertise to an entity or organization, you all choose the core function of TA, that's correct? And then when the support or expertise is provided to an individual, consumer, or a person with disability, you choose the core function of other direct services or demonstration services. And just to clarify for these, I think there was a follow-up question to me about, you know, when the support is provided to an individual, but the individual represents the organization. And in that case, it is considered TA. Does anyone still have questions about this, you know, how to choose between TA and other direct services or demonstration services? Because I know there was quite a big conversation about this.
This is Amy from Missouri. what if we have a faculty member, a LEN faculty member that is on a board, and we've entered that as a TA, the board is AAIDD, and through AAIDD, they sponsor a guest lecturer to come in. How do you count that lecturer, or do you? Or I should say speaker, sponsoring speaker.
Would that be a community training or continuing education, depending on if you offered CMEs?
Okay, commune. So you could choose between community or CUEs, couldn't you?
This is Lori in Nashville. I actually did have a question about this. So this was specifically referencing back to probably two calls ago when we were talking about information referral service sort of activities and how a few of us used to consider that technical assistance, but it was sort of determined that, no, that's not really technical assistance. It's more of other direct model services. And in terms of reporting numbers for that, we've got a referral system or an information hotline, basically. We track emails that come into it. We track phone calls that come in. We also track web hits. And it seems excessive to count, 20,000 web hits as, part of that information, but once they get on the website, they could really be accessing the same sort of information they'd be getting via email or over the phone. And I was just looking for a little thought on how to report that without seeming just overblown.
Repeating slightly, because I mean, I followed a bit, but not towards the end of how they switched to the website from the email. Would you mind repeating that?
Yeah. So in a couple phone calls ago, we talked about how to report sort of an information referral line. We've actually got a couple of them, but one of them is pretty significant. And so we would report that as an other direct or model service, just based on the information I got from that other phone call. But when I'm putting in the number of recipients, we track the number of phone calls that come in. We can also track the number of emails that come in. It's also on the website, it's a searchable database. And so we track our web hits. And so, adding all that up, it comes to, a significant number in a fiscal year. And in talking to my director, we agree it seems a little overblown to report that, 20,000 we've provided, services to 20,000 people. On the other hand, we don't really have a good way of knowing through the web hits what people are taking away from it. And it really, some of that is honestly the same sort of information they'd be getting from a phone call or an email.
Thank you. That's what I was wondering, just to be sure I got it right, because it does seem like you're not sure when someone comes to the website what information they take from it. But as to the emails and the calls, it does seem like all those can be counted.
Right, but so should we just include the emails and phone calls? And just list the website as a product?
Well, if you have a website that's a resource on itself, mm-hmm. as a, in its entirety, that can be mm-hmm. entered as a product, correct?
Okay.
But in terms of website hits, I mean, unless you know what they're getting, can you even see if they downloaded something from the website or what they got from the website?
I can find that out. I don't specifically know what it is.
And I think that's a good question. Maybe it's a good question. Do others have websites like that that are resources and, you know, track how people use the websites?
Karina, I have a question. So if you're counting websites as a product, which I think it is, then do you count the amount of hits you get on that website as part of the dissemination of the product?
Well, that is a good question, and I think for the most part, websites are not counted as product unless they are a specific resource. You know, the center website is not supposed to be counted as a product. In terms of hits, I mean, I guess it could have been counted as the number disseminated, but right now it no longer matters because the quantities are not required for reporting. So, I mean, I guess you could use them, but you don't have to.
But hopefully the website, every center's website has a bunch of information and resources to whomever is visiting, be it providers, consumers, or students.
Correct. And if you keep track of downloads, you could, count the number of downloads as the quantity disseminated for a resource. It's just that a center's website has always been viewed as the place to disseminate information, but not a product in itself, because people come to get other products from the website.
But you can count whatever is downloaded as a product or resource and count the number of times that it's been downloaded? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, for certain products, and if you have a report that's on your website, you can count the number of downloads as the quantity disseminated. I mean, it's not perfectly accurate because, of course, you're not sure that everyone who downloaded actually read the report.
Right.
But it is a way that I know some did use to obtain the quantity disseminated for a report.
Likewise with videos that's on your website? The number of views that you've had?
I mean, I would think so. Again, this is what I've heard from others. And if anyone else wants to jump in and give examples about this, please feel free to. Or are folks happy to not have to keep track of quantities anymore?
Very happy we don't have to keep track of quantities anymore.
Well, thank you for that. And are there any other questions for this call? Okay, then I'll take silence as a no, and I will send out a reminder closer to the time, but we do have the next call scheduled for mid-July, for July 13th. I'll send out a survey before the call, but I also imagine at that time it will be a lot about reporting. So thank you everyone for participating, and as always, feel free to call or email whenever you have questions.
Thank you.
Have a great remainder of your afternoon.
Thank you.